Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, plans for a new mobilization against the rule of Wall Street money. Nurses tell both political parties that the U.S. needs a real healthcare system. And our own Dr. Jared Ball debuts his new book. It's a mixtape manifesto.
But first, the savage NATO bombing of Libya's capital city continues in all-out attempt at regime change. We spoke with Dr. Vijay Prasad, professor of international studies at Trinity College in Connecticut. The Europeans of NATO especially appears to be surprised that Muammar Gaddafi's government has hung on for this long.
I think that's correct. I think there's some naivety in the, among the war planners. And it's remarkable that every time they have a new conflict, when Iraq demonstrated that for at least 4 years, the Baathists and then the Iraqi people held off against the American occupation, you know, between 2004 and 2007, there was very fierce resistance in Iraq. And right after that, there was some thinking came that it's not that easy to put troops on the ground. You know, even David Cameron, just before the Libyan engagement, gave a speech where he said you cannot bring democracy from 14,000 feet. That was just before, I think in February he said that. So every time they get into this mood of going to war, it seems they forget their own lessons that they have just learned and articulated. It was themselves who said that it's hard to have this kind of campaign, and yet there was a way of mutual hallucination. They kept saying this will be over in a few weeks. Now, the bombing started March 20th. We are now in June. There seems no end in sight. Rasmussen of NATO has told Al Arabiya that they have conducted, I think he said something like in the tens of thousands of bombing raids, there are about 50 attacks on Tripoli a day. So they are obviously once again stepped in their own lessons.
Well, maybe instead of 40,000 feet, they believe that they'll accomplish their mission, whatever it is, from a much lower altitude with their attack helicopters.
Well, this is, I suppose, what they're expecting. I mean, at the contact group meeting, I thought it was very interesting how the Benghazi team was asking for certain kinds of targets and certain kind of logistical and armed support, and the NATO command was saying, no, this is what we are going to do. In other words, we are a long way away, of course, from the UN, United Nations Resolution 1973. But what this dispute at the contact group meeting at Abu Dhabi demonstrated was that the Benghazi group is trying to exert itself a little bit. And, you know, people should recognize that it's NATO in command. I mean, this is not NATO giving assistance to the Benghazi group. The Benghazi group were, you know, trying to get NATO to please do what they want, and NATO has its own agenda. So people who at this stage continue to say that the Benghazi group is in charge, I think are grossly deluded.
And what does that say about the legitimacy of that movement, which claims to be revolutionary?
Well, the movement certainly has its own legs, and I'm not going to do a litmus test whether they are revolutionary or not. But they have made, to my mind, a grotesque error, which is that if you yoke your revolution or if you yoke your struggle to the side of imperialism, history has shown us that you are going to get destroyed. You know, very few are canny enough to be surfers of those very high waves where they are able to stay above the wave. You know, most amateur surfers are going to get totally demolished by the wave. And the wave is imperialism, and you cannot ride imperialism. You know, imperialism is going to utilize you. So whatever their own instincts, whatever their own, you know, expectations, their own understanding of their struggle, by yoking themselves to imperialism, they have undoubtedly, destroyed their own ability to control their evolution. So again, you know, they are where they are, but the biggest mistake has been to become the handmaidens of NATO, because NATO has demonstrated that it is in charge.
We wrote that the Benghazi people ought to pay close attention to those helicopters because they might find them turned on them.
Well, precisely. I mean, you know, this is part of the history of imperialism, that imperialism picks its allies when it chooses and turns on them when it chooses. You know, this is the biography of Saddam Hussein. This is the biography of Manuel Noriega. I mean, you know, we have any number of books now that demonstrate without any hesitation how imperialism picks its targets one way or the other. The most recent candidate for this rogue gallery is Osama bin Laden, you know, who was alongside the imperial adventure in Afghanistan and then is the enemy number one of imperialism. So I quite agree with you that if you yoke yourself to imperialism, be careful, because history demonstrates that either it spits you out when things go badly, as it spat out Ahmad Chalabi in Iraq, or it decides that you are now the the immediate enemy, as it did with Saddam Hussein. So be careful, people of Benghazi.
The organization that has been treated as totally irrelevant to this situation is the African Union.
Well, you know, the African Union has had a very difficult position here. I mean, one, you know, we have to recognize that Libya played a very important role in the African Union. And, you know, the fact is, in the last 15 years, the West has not allowed, has in fact sabotaged the African Union's attempts to come into its own. And one has seen that in various pushes by the West into Africa to try to command political events. And most recently, we see this in West Africa. So the African Union has never been allowed to come into its own. In this particular instance, the African Union was compromised a little bit by the vote that South Africa took on behalf of the no-fly zone in March, that is UN Resolution 1973. So there is some complexity in the African Union. But once again, the African Union, before 1973, vote of Resolution 1973, was prepared to come in and start a process of negotiation. Once again, the West decided to cut that down to size, and therefore never gave the African Union an authentic role to play in this instance. So suddenly, they have been sidelined. But again, this is part of a last 10 to 15-year policy of sidelining authentic African organizations from commanding the destiny of Africa. You know, we saw that in the question of Zimbabwe. We saw that in the question of West Africa. And certainly around the highly politicized question of Darfur, the African Union was not even allowed to sit at the table.
In demonizing Colonel Gaddafi, the corporate media give the impression, and maybe they believe it, that Gaddafi has no support. And once he is killed or leaves, well, that will be it.
No, this is very wrong. I mean, it's whatever one thinks of Gaddafi, he certainly has support among some sections, very considerable sections of the population. So one cannot say that, you know, he is without support. That would be very silly. I mean, you know, they were saying the same thing about Slobodan Milosevic. You saw recently when Ratko Mladic was arrested and brought to The Hague, there was a mass demonstration in Serbia. You know, there is a section in Serbia even today which is pro-Milosevic, pro-Ratko Mladic. In the same way, there are going to be very large sections in Libya that will stand with Gaddafi. And it's very silly that the media has put itself, not just the media, but also NATO has put itself in the hole. You will see headlines that will say things like, Gaddafi bombed civilians, or Gaddafi attacks Brega. And then it will say NATO conducts, you know, air sorties, whatever. You know, they have personalized the entire conflict. This means that the space for negotiation is cut down dramatically. Why I mentioned Serbia is they are following the Kosovo model. Aerial bombardment is the first part of it. The second part of it is make sure a part of the country declares itself the legitimate government. In that case, the Kosovo government was created. And the third thing is you send the International Criminal Court a dossier and let them prepare charges against the leader. They did that to Milosevic. In other words, you make a situation where the only conceivable outcome is the destruction of the country. And these three elements are being followed almost as if through a rule book in Libya. They have done aerial bombardment, they have recognized Benghazi as a legitimate government, and they have an ICC dossier, you know, to bring charges against Gaddafi, and now about giving Viagra, apparently, to his troops. So if these three things are following, just as in Yugoslavia, the outcome is going to be the devastation of Libya.
And could we expect some reminders of Iraq as well?
Well, it depends how what happens, you know, with the so-called end game here. It's, to my mind, likely that if there is some military breakthrough, there will be an Iraq scenario, certainly. There will be a big fight back, especially if there are European troops in Libya. Because whatever people will think about Gaddafi, they are very patriotic people in Libya, and they will not stand for a European occupation. You know, there's a long, almost 80-year history of lionizing Libyan resistance to European colonialism, and that is going to play a big role if there are European boots on the ground. Now, there are, of course, European advisors on the ground now, but if the boots actually come, which is what is going to be necessary, I think, if there is to be a military end game. The rebels themselves, I don't think, are capable of taking Tripoli. So if you get to that point, yes, it's certainly going to be Iraq. I don't think currently that is on the cards. I think they're going to continue to try to whittle against Gaddafi's institutional support and isolate him. In other words, we are not in the situation of Iraq. This is really very much like Yugoslavia. In that case, there may not be an Iraq scenario. There may not be a popular insurgency. It will be a different character.
But if Gaddafi is killed, one school of thought is they have been trying to kill him. The other is that they have been showing that they can kill him. If he disappears from the scene, then should one expect that his supporters would just fade into the woodwork and retire?
No, then it's a bloodbath. I mean, this is the terrible, I would think this is the juvenile school of thought called humanitarian intervention. Because, you know, the outcome of this kind of campaign might end up being, you know, tens of thousands dead through bloodbath. And that bloodbath has to be on the hands of the humanitarian interventionists. I think it's quite wrong for us to forget that they will champion wars to save people, and when the wars turn bad, they apologize and say, we didn't expect this outcome. Well, you know what? This is history. The reason we study history is to trace the possibilities of certain outcomes. And this outcome, many of us say, is going to happen. And it's about time that those humanitarian interventionists, you know, take responsibility for this. Because they provide, in a sense, the kind of academic legitimacy for a ruthless strategy of dominating the world.
Dr. Vijay Prasad is author of the book, A People's History of the Third World.
In St. Petersburg, Florida, we caught up with Omali Yeshitela of the African People's Socialist Party and the Black is Back Coalition. We asked Yeshitela if African Americans won't break with President Obama over his attack on an African country, what will make them break with him?
I think that the problem is, in this instance, is not so much black folk. I think it is that terrible leadership that has positioned itself as representatives of our community. I think that's where the terrible inadequacy is. And I also think that many others of us suffer from a lack of organizational capacity. I think that's what the issue is. In my experience, just listening to just ordinary African working people, not only are they opposed to what they understand about the Libya issue, but it goes much further than that in terms of even opposition to the purported assassination of Osama bin Laden. So there is a growing distaste of American imperialism just out there among ordinary people, even though it may not be put in any kind of ideologically sophisticated terms, and even though most of the people don't have an organizational capacity to make that distress representative out there in the political world. That's my job, and that's something that I haven't succeeded in being able to do up to now, but it will happen.
It seems that President Obama is not just a continuity of Bush policy, but an upgrade of the Bush doctrine.
It's an upgrade, but I truly believe that it is an upgrade of a certain kind of desperation that will play itself out. I think that the Obama phenomenon is the last significant opportunity that imperialism, U.S. imperialism has, and I think it's going to fail. And I think increasingly it is failing. When, again, we talk about not so much what people articulate in a certain way, but how about Obama, but how people talk about what's happening with black people in this country, in this world. There is no patriotism here, even if people are talking about, and increasingly they're not saying how much they like Obama. So I think something is afoot here, that it's afoot around the world. And America is part of the world as quietly as it's been kept, as much as people like Obama and the ruling elite and even sectors of what represents itself as the Black Liberation Movement in this country would like to deny it. The reality is that America is a part of the world, and the overall crisis that we see being expressed in places like Egypt, in places like Tunisia and Yemen and all these other places, and in occupied Palestine that they call Israel. All of these places represent a changing world. And also we see that things are changing, at least in the consciousness of ordinary young people here in this country as well. I want to point out that the people who are coming into our movement, young people now, one of the things that's really striking is they don't bring with them a lot of the same old baggage that old leftists, even people in their 40s, have brought in the past. And they are young, dynamic, they're angry, and they hate what they see happening in the world. And that's in this country. It is also true throughout Europe with the black people we're working with, who many of whom are expatriates from the continent of Africa, sometimes first generation living in Europe. It's true of the work that we're doing in South America and other places. It's just an incredible kind of thing that's happening with young African people who really hate imperialism and are determined to change things. And the problem up to now has been the fact that we haven't had the leadership and organizational capacity on the ground to facilitate the opposition that young people are expressing in a thousand different ways. But Egypt is here in this country. The conditions that gave rise to that and the conditions that gave rise to Tunisia, et cetera, and it's getting worse every day. Anybody looking at the economic indicators in this country that's representative in so many different ways, increasingly politically in this country, can understand why more and more African people, especially young Africans, are growing to hate and willing to mobilize against imperialism. And we're going to see that reflected in struggling against Obama as well.
When this administration came in, there was a lot of talk about using soft power, being less belligerent or sounding less belligerent. But we see all we get now is the hammer, the military solution. Isn't that in itself a measure of imperialism's defeats?
It is an extraordinary mission and measure of the defeat of imperialism. You know, I mean, it was just, how long ago? A year and a half or so that Obama was in Egypt, you know, going assalamu alaikum, with the assumption that somehow this surface, this cosmetic trappings was going to be enough to seduce people into a certain kind of unity with imperialism. He was in Ghana and Africa, et cetera. And then the euphoria that was experienced by black people here and around the world, I'm telling you, it's wearing off. And it is a measure of defeat that they have to resort to the same kind of techniques that the former administration had used in each instance an opportunity to rescue an imperialism in severe, deep, profound crisis. So, yeah, it is a measure of defeat that the fact that they have to fall back on the same kind of war machinery that the Bush regime used prior to Obama's election. And I think that, among other things, that those of us who were willing to make the criticism of Obama early on, prior to and subsequent to his election, though it is not something to be happy about, can, you know, obviously be vindicated in that we understood that it was imperialism that we were dealing with, even when we called it George Bush. And the problem was that, and continues to be for some people, that they cannot see imperialism when it's called Barack Hussein Obama. They cannot see, or they are unwilling to recognize that imperialism is imperialism is imperialism.
The campaign for 2012 is already on, especially the real campaign, which is the drive to get the rich man's money. Will all in the black community be asked to fall in line once again? What is the Black Is Back Coalition's response?
I truly believe that we have a responsibility to try and really initiate a campaign that will expose imperialism. I think that's the critical thing. Some people will call it an anti-Obama campaign, but the objective, I really think, has to be to expose imperialism, because imperialism, again, is coming at the people in blackface, and I think that we have a responsibility to try to educate to the extent that it's possible. And even as I say this, you know, there are many forces who plan to be in motion, who are part of what they call the black left, et cetera. Even as they complain about some of the things that imperialism are doing, they are Obamites, and they will be making all kinds of apologies and excuses for Obama. So I think Black Is Back needs to really develop a capacity to outreach and educate and do as much as possible to expose imperialism in the face of Obama. Cannot be for peace and for Obama, and you cannot be for prosperity, and you cannot be for progress and Obama. You cannot have those things. Prosperity will only come for the ruling elite, finance capital. Prosperity, to some extent, will come to the military establishment until they begin to experience some of the defeats that I think are going to be on the horizon, even for the military establishment with all of this splendid weapons and what have you. But it is not something that's on the horizon. You cannot have both Obama and prosperity unless that prosperity is achieved as a consequence of the struggle against Obama, which is struggling against imperialism.
Omali Yeshitela is one of the speakers at the June 24 conference in Chicago of NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America.
Political activists from around the country plan a mobilization in Washington on October 6th under the banner Stop the Machine, Create a New World. Organizer Kevin Zee says protesters will try to turn D.C.'s Freedom Plaza into a U.S. version of Egypt's Tahrir Square.
Well, it means that we're trying to get Americans to finally stand up and resist the corporate government and its undermining of the basic necessities that people need. It's continuing of sending money to the top of the oligarchy while the rest of the United States, the rest of the middle class and working class gets poorer. Means stopping the war. And so we want to stand with the machine. It's called Stop the Machine, Create a New World. And we're going to get people together beginning on a Wednesday, and we'll stay until we feel satisfied that we're getting the response we want.
This sounds pretty much open-ended. The people at Tahrir Square stayed until Mubarak stepped down. What's the departure point for this event?
Well, that's a really interesting question. You know, we're watching a lot of revolutions around the world and really learning from each one of them. I think the one that this is closest to is Spain. You don't hear about it much in the U.S. media, but Spain has been in revolt for almost a month now, occupying a plaza in their capital. They're developing the demands as they protest, and they're having a process where they have committees that discuss each issue, democracy, economy, and other issues. And like, I think their first demand, for example, is ending the two-party system. They have a duopoly like we do, and they're not satisfied having those limited choices. And so we'll see how it develops. We're going to be setting up committees that deal with all the various issues from the war to the economy to health care to democracy, and we'll debate and discuss what our top priorities will be. And we'll also be debating, I think the key question is, what would be a show of good faith that would make it acceptable for us to end this protest? And so we're not going to decide that now. We want to get lots of people involved before we make those decisions so that the decision that is made is something that people agree on who participate. We want to start to, you know, show the democracy that we want to have. We don't want to have a dictatorial, you know, handful of people say this is what we stand for. We're going to bring a lot of people into this process and come up with something people agree to.
In that duopoly you spoke of in Spain, the Socialist Party was in fact the one that imposed these austerity measures.
That's right. The International Monetary Fund essentially dictated to the socialist government that they had to do that. And that's one of the problems with our international finance system is obviously the end result of Saddam Hussein refusing to cooperate with the United States. Now, before that happens, though, you have the IMF and the World Bank making their demands on people. And right now, Spain's going through that process where the IMF came in and said, you need austerity budgets or else. And Spain, you know, kowtowed to the IMF, and now the people are saying, hey, how about us first? And I think what Spain needs to do is recognize that the people come first, the bankers don't come first. And if they stand up to the bankers and do what's necessary, their economy will grow and flourish. If they do what the banksters say, their economy will shrink.
And speaking of the duopoly here, both parties, rather the head of the Democratic Party and the Republicans, agree that budget deficits are the main problem, not unemployment and other social needs.
Exactly, and that's the key thing about this October. October 6th is the 10th anniversary of the Afghanistan war, but October 1st is the beginning of a fiscal year for the federal government, and that will be an austerity budget for everything except the military, intelligence gathering, and homeland security. Everything else will be stable or cut, which stable means a cut because it doesn't keep up with inflation. So all the basic necessities of the people will be undermined, all the needs to protect the environment will be undermined, all the regulation of big business will be undermined, but war and intelligence gathering, those kinds of things will continue to have growing budgets. And I think that really highlights why this is a gathering that's going to bring people together across issues. It's not just end the war, it's bring economic justice as well and end the corporate duopoly and end the corporatism that's dominating our government.
Sounds in a way like the poor people's march that Dr. King had planned. That wouldn't be a one-day affair, but a permanent or an open-ended presence in Washington. I guess that requires a different kind of organizing than for a one-day event.
No question about it, and it's going to be very challenging, but we have a lot of good people involved, a lot of good organizations involved, people who are experienced in organizing various kinds of demonstrations, and they'll bring all that experience to bear on this effort. And I think you're right. It does kind of harken back to Dr. King's Poor People's March. I mean, these are not new issues. You know, we have seen these same problems throughout American history, and for so often we see Americans just accepting it, but it's now gotten to the point where it's no longer acceptable. We've seen stagnant wages since the 70s. Now we're seeing Social Security threatened, Medicare threatened, basic necessities of American people taken away from them. We're seeing union rights destroyed. So it's become a crisis point, and the American people need to stand up now. And I think this, the time is right. I mean, you know, you look at the Arab Spring, you look at the summer of the Europe awakening, and I think the autumn will be the time for the United States to awaken and to take to the streets and really start to make some demands. Change can happen. People need to have the confidence that we can make change. The people really do have the power if they are willing to use it and are united in that effort. I really believe that united people can overcome this corporate power that dominates our government.
Do you anticipate that this event or open-ended event has the potential to gathering a broader base than anti-war demonstrations, for example?
No question. We are intentionally going at this, focusing on a wide range of issues, the lack of health care for 50 million Americans, the poverty rate at record highs, the stagnant wages, the loss of union rights, the environmental devastation, the lack of ability to face up to climate change, the lack of ability to face up to the energy crisis and the oil and nuclear industries, as well as the wars. And so all these things are connected. The common theme behind all these issues that keep the status quo in place is concentrated corporate power. And that's what's behind the government. That's who Obama represents. That's who the Republicans represent. That's who the Democratic leadership represents. They work for concentrated corporate capital, and that's what we're here to challenge.
That was Kevin Zee speaking from upstate New York.
Nurses converged on Washington for protests at the White House, Capitol Hill, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, demanding a Main Street contract for the people of America. Among them was Gene Ross, one of the presidents of the union National Nurses United. What about claims that the country is too broke to provide a health care system that serves everybody?
Oh, our nation is not broke. We remain the richest nation on the planet, and they know it. But it makes for good rhetoric when you want to do away with rights and cut costs and give it to the few people at the top. Money doesn't just evaporate. It's there. It's just in the hands of fewer and fewer people. So what we need to do is get back to the basics of what we said we wanted to do in this country, well, at least from the time of the New Deal of Roosevelt, and get that back into perspective, because the American people still want those things. They've just been focused on a bunch of rhetoric and things that are designed to turn us against each other, those of us that work for a living, so that we won't realize what's really going on.
The Republicans seem bent on destroying Medicaid as we know it, but National Nurses United say that's the opposite of a solution. Medicaid should be expanded to include everybody.
Yes, Medicare and Medicaid for all would be an ideal single-payer system. It would cover everyone. The way to fund it is good. You just have to talk about removing that cap or changing it at least. And that way we could cover everyone and save the kind of money that they say they want to save with their cuts, and it will never happen. If you look, even those that put forward these responses, cut this, cut that, the Ryan budget, for example, if you play it out and they've had the accountants look at it, they would even have to admit that what they say they want to achieve won't be achieved.
And you say this can only be achieved in the realm of health care by single payer.
Absolutely. You need to take out the middleman. You need to make sure that people are covered, that they can get care when they need it. And the rest of our Main Street contract deals with preventing illness, keeping people well. You know, you are going to save money if they don't always have to go into the hospital in an emergency, which is when people are going in now. They're putting off routine care. They're putting off sometimes even emergent procedures, trying to delay them. So it's sort of like, okay, I'm here in your emergency room. Get me a little bit well so I can go back to work. I'll be sick at work, but at least I'll be able to keep up with my payments. I'll have an income. I can't afford to be sick now.
You don't reserve your criticism just for the Republicans. The Obama administration is not for single-payer health care. Has President Obama's health care measure made it more difficult to pass single-payer legislation?
It may have, and I will say this. We have always been in support of single-payer. The president himself, when he was running for office, said he was. But for whatever reason, we get a lot of rhetoric from both sides about the fact that this isn't the time, it's unachievable, and we know that it isn't unachievable. We also know, as we talk to people across the country, people are ready for it. They're clamoring for it. So we just have to have a real decent discussion about it and not be afraid of taking people on. What we need are politicians who will stand up for Main Street, for those of us who work for a living, and get really honest about who they're fighting for. And since that's not going to come easily, we are starting this now so that people can see this is time for a movement, a real movement, just like we had in the 60s for civil rights to get us out of Vietnam, those kinds of things. The only thing that appears to really change things in this country and to move our politicians to do the right thing is to get out in the streets, push, push, push until they can't ignore and deny it anymore.
Nurses seem to be among the most militant sections of the union movement. Why is that?
I think maybe it's because of what we actually do for a living and how people see us. You know, we kind of are the protectors. We've been called the canaries in the coal mine. We're the last safety net for the people, certainly when they're inside a hospital. And it just, the more we talk and people share their stories with us, we realize that the only way to get people healthy, and really keep this country healthy, get it back to where it needs to be and better, is that we look at all these factors in our Main Street contract. For example, the jobs at living wages, equal access to quality education, health care for all, secure retirement, good housing, safe, clean environment, no pollution, just kind of restoring the promise of America here, because all these things affect your health, your physical and your mental health. You can say all you want about personal responsibility and people need to take care of themselves, stop smoking, exercise more, et cetera, et cetera. When you're working 2 and 3 jobs, it's a little hard to fit in exercise. And when you're stressed out, is that the time you think you're going to think of quitting smoking and things like that? Stress causes illness, and I don't think people are picking up on this. The loss of a job, no way to fend for yourself and your family, that causes illness, and no one is addressing that in our government right now.
Jean Ross of National Nurses United.
President Obama's good friend and chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, Austin Goosby, has turned in his resignation. Dr. Timothy Canova, professor of international economic law at California's Chapman University, thinks this is an opportunity for Obama to take a different economic course. Dr. Canova would like to see a chairman who will put U.S. jobs first. But what makes Canova think such a person will emerge from this administration?
You know, they say that politicians rarely see the light, but they often feel the heat. And it could be that the Obama administration might be feeling the heat a bit now. The public opinion polls show that something like 60% of the American public is critical of President Obama's handling of the economy. If they're reading the polls closely, they'll see that people are very concerned about jobs and jobs and jobs, and much more concerned about that than the deficit. So one can only hope that President Obama will return to the themes that he campaigned on in 2008.
And second behind jobs is housing. You've suggested that funds that are left over in the Troubled Asset Relief Program, that's TARP, intervene in the housing market.
Yes, I think the problem for Obama now is that he's out of traditional policy tools. The Republicans in the House of Representatives won't make it easy for him. So the idea of, let's say, a public works program like a Civilian Conservation Corps or a Works Projects Administration will not really get off the ground. The Republicans will just prevent anything like that from happening. But one tool that Obama still has is the TARP program. And in the past, TARP has been used to prop up the big Wall Street banks. It has also been used to help General Motors and Chrysler get back on their feet. And I think it would be useful for the administration to start using TARP to help people struggling with their mortgages and also to help state and local governments that are struggling with their budget problems.
So far, very few people who were in trouble with these mortgages have been helped by the Obama program.
It's true. They had promised that their program would help about 4 million Americans stay in their homes, and I believe that it's been more of the order of something like around 700,000. So it's been a small fraction of what they were hoping. And foreclosures are still at a peak, and housing prices, they continue to fall during the first quarter of this year. So it's hard to imagine any recovery when housing continues to fall. It's also hard to imagine any recovery in housing when there are about 20 million Americans or more who are either officially or unofficially out of work.
Some would say it's hard to imagine a recovery in either jobs or housing with Timothy Geithner remaining as Treasury Secretary.
Well, I'm one who agrees with that. I think Timothy Geithner has carried a lot of water for Wall Street. He's been in a great position to help the middle class with housing and also to weigh in on budget issues to help the jobless. And he's been completely silent and ineffective on those counts. I don't see much progress with a Treasury Secretary like Geithner.
You'd like to reinvigorate what you describe as the country's dormant manufacturing base. But the manufacturing base didn't just fall asleep. There were higher powers of finance that put it to sleep.
Well, that's true. Manufacturing was in decline for much of the last decade or more, and I think it's a big result of the free trade agenda that we've watched in both Democratic and Republican administrations. It really reached a free fall, of course, with the recession. I think since the start of the recession in 2007, the United States has lost about 2 million additional manufacturing jobs. Now, turning that around won't be an easy task. I think it will require a renewed commitment to negotiating trade agreements that keep the interests of labor at the forefront. But I think it also requires some changes in corporate governance in the United States. You know, even if there is some revived demand in the American economy so that businesses might want to start investing, why would American businesses want to invest in the United States and create jobs in the United States when they can do that much cheaper in China or Brazil or India? What I think is an important or an interesting model to follow would be the German. And when you look at German companies, they've got half of their directors are representatives of their labor unions. And when you've got that kind of a dialogue going on at the board of directors level in supervisory boards, you're going to get different corporate outcomes. And our corporate governance system here is a much different corporate governance system. It doesn't take into consideration the interests of their workers or of the local communities whatsoever.
Well, we certainly have the same kind of culture in this administration. For his top jobs advisor, President Obama chose the CEO of General Electric, which laid off one-fifth of its workforce over the past decade and pays very, very little, if any, domestic taxes.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And when you look at who he has appointed in key positions in Treasury, and also Ben Bernanke, he reappointed him to chair the Federal Reserve. These are people who have Republican and Wall Street credentials right down the line. So it's quite troubling. I understand the need to work across the aisle and to try to build coalitions with Republicans to get things done. But it does seem that this administration, which promised so much change, has instead given us a lot of continuity with the old order.
But you believe that grumblings from the base of the Democratic Party may force Obama to change his tune?
One can only hope. We're going into an election year, and there's always the possibility that the Obama campaign will take the left of the party for granted. Particularly, it seems as if there might not be any primary challenge to the president. And by taking the left for granted, maybe he's going to try to move further to the middle. This is exactly what Bill Clinton did. It got Bill Clinton reelected, but of course, Bill Clinton was running against a relatively weak opponent in Bob Dole. And the economy was doing not so badly in 1996. For Obama to count on being able to win re-election by tacking to the middle and taking the left for granted, taking the young people for granted, taking the middle class for granted, so to speak, I think is a very dangerous tactic when the Republicans could have a stronger candidate than Bob Dole, and the economy is in a much, much weaker condition than it was in 1996. The official unemployment rate is now 9.1%. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has a measurement of a wider measurement of the unemployment and underemployment situation in this country, which measures official unemployment as well as part-time workers who are seeking full-time work and can't find it, discouraged workers, people who have given up and dropped out of the labor force. And according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that number is almost 1 in 5 American workers. And then, of course, when we look at communities of color, the picture is much, much worse. For young African-American and Latino youth, we're talking about unemployment figures that are well into the 20s and maybe 30% or higher.
That was Dr. Timothy Canova at Chapman University in California.
A recent U.S. Agency for International Development report claims that far fewer Haitians were killed and displaced than estimated by the Haitian government or by the International Organization for Migration. The report has cast a pall over earthquake aid to Haiti. But Alex Main of Washington's Center for Economic and Policy Research says an important part of that report has been overlooked.
It's interesting that the media has focused exclusively on this sort of very controversial number when, in fact, the report, and particularly the sort of harder evidence that the report contains, actually points to another problem that, in my mind, is a much more serious problem, which is the fact that you have hundreds of thousands of people that are currently occupying buildings that could very easily collapse if there's another tremor or if there's particularly bad weather. These are homes that have actually been tagged by teams of engineers. This was done fairly early on, shortly after the earthquake. They were identified as homes that could easily collapse and that should not be occupied, pending either significant repair or their demolishing and replacement with stronger buildings. And yet they are being occupied at this point. This is really the hardest data that the report contains. What the report says afterwards about the death toll figures, also about the amount of people in the camps, is not based on really very, very strong methodology. There's a lot of speculation involved, and I think some of those figures can be easily put into doubt. I think where the report is strong, and this is the story that's been entirely missed, unfortunately, by the mainstream media, is pointing out that there's this huge problem. Many, many Haitians that, because they have no alternative, are living in buildings that could collapse and we could see another disaster with a high death toll. If you put aside the analysis that's in the report and you look at the hard figures, which are based on a door-to-door poll that was done around the city of Port-au-Prince into buildings that were marked as being heavily damaged and dangerous to live in, here you have some very hard numbers that show that you have a huge problem, that as many as 570,000 people are living in something like 85,000 homes that could easily collapse. And then you have additional important number of buildings that could also collapse, that are at a less dangerous level, but are still very risky to live in. This is a huge problem. These buildings should not be occupied at the moment. And I think it's a real sign of the failure of the overall relief effort that so many individuals are resorting to buildings that they know themselves to be very dangerous to live in. It's simply because housing hasn't been provided and places where they can sort of have minimal shelter in minimally decent conditions have not been provided to these people.
However, in the aspects of the report that the media has picked up on, which call into question the veracity or even the honesty of the Haitian government, might have the effect of causing people from donor nations to believe that giving Haiti money is throwing money down a rat hole.
I think that's what's, you know, very, very dangerous about the way this report is being used. Again, you have a set of numbers that are hard numbers based on a serious poll that took place in these damaged neighborhoods throughout Port-au-Prince. And then you have speculation based on these numbers that carries over to death toll numbers and other areas, which were not sort of the main point of the research in the first place. And the media, seeing a sensational story, jumped on those numbers, the death toll numbers and so on, and indeed have, you know, sensationalized this to the point where they have gone as far as sort of questioning whether, you know, international aid will continue to Haiti given the possibility that there are false death toll numbers. I think my personal opinion is that the death toll numbers at this stage, I think it's very, very hard to sort of come up with a very accurate number. I think that's always been a difficulty. And in any case, we're dealing with a moot point. There were a huge amount of people killed, no matter how many. It was certainly more than any other natural disaster in this hemisphere for at least 100 years. It's a major, major disaster that requires a real strong international relief effort. And that absolutely needs to continue because up to now, the relief effort has really not had very positive results on the ground. The relief effort needs to be revised and it needs to be improved. And in no case should it be stopped or diminished in any way.
Alex Main speaking from Washington.
Black Agenda Reports' Dr. Jared Ball has released his new book. It's titled I Mix What I Like, a Mixtape Manifesto. We asked Dr. Ball, where does the mixtape fit in the liberation scheme of things?
I am at least trying to argue that it fits nicely in the tradition of underground emancipatory journalistic practice among the world's colonized people, that it emerged from colonial antagonisms, it responds nicely to them, and if applied as an outlet or as a mouthpiece of political organization, I think today's hip-hop activist community and those working with those communities could deploy the mixtape and its traditional use and its own culturally specific history as a method of 21st century emancipatory journalism. And I'm in fact arguing that whether it's the mixtape or not, that kind of journalistic practice needs to be much more in vogue, regardless of the particular medium.
But this mixtape medium is valuable, I get from your book, because it circumvents the filter, the all-encompassing filter of corporate America.
Well, at least it did initially and still does in many aspects. So mixtapes traditionally they originate as that which circumvents any sort of state or corporate control over the cultural expression of a colonized population. But like all that is produced from such oppressed communities, it has suffered a degree of corporate co-optation. But the mixtape itself, with its history emerging with the DJ culture in the 1970s, became and was hip-hop or rap music's first national, or what I'm calling a national mass medium, but also just its first mass medium in general, because there were no outlets that were open to this newly burgeoning form of colonized cultural expression, now known as hip-hop. There was no outlet. There was no rap radio. There was no even co-opted forms of MTV and BET video and radio outlets. So the mixtape was initially used as cassette recordings of DJ mixes, house parties, or specifically tailored mixes for an individual or a group in a community, and distributed in underground fashion. Barbershops, beauty salons, taxi cabs, just in the street vending, and became, again, the initial mass medium, something that circumvented existing media structures, and to this day still does, despite in many ways being heavily refashioned and co-opted by those same corporate colonizing forces that impact every other form of media or journalistic or cultural expression that, again, all oppressed communities have to deal with. So I'm just arguing that since the mixtape does still have this kind of sort of guerrilla media history, and it's something that particularly for Black and Latin Americans of my generation and the hip-hop community in general has a real cultural relativity that many other forms of media making don't have. So I just wanted to make an argument that it be turned into, or more so turned into, a more consciously political, again, emancipatory journalistic venture. We tried to model one here in the Washington, D.C. area with Free Mix Radio, and I detail how that works and even express some of the ways it has not worked and some of my own failings in the project, and encourage other people to pick up where I and my colleagues have fallen and to do it better. But certainly I just think the mixtape is an underappreciated aspect of hip-hop history in terms of academic or journalistic history or research. And the mixtape is one of my favorite forms of cultural expression. And I just wanted to offer something for my community and my colleagues, more of a political document and argument how we could use it in the 21st century to challenge all the, to face, to resist in many ways all the new challenges that we have to deal with, which include new forms of media co-optation and consolidation, even in the so-called new advanced era of media technology and social media with Facebook and Twitter and so on, and the internet in general. The mixtape, I still think, should play and can play and, in fact, needs to play a much more strong underground emancipatory role in the 21st century.
So we're speaking of the mixtape as one delivery system of hip-hop political thought or worldview, but what is the hip-hop worldview?
Well, that's something that, again, has to be worked out, and one of the other arguments I'm trying to, somewhat in passing, make in the book is that if this expression, hip-hop nation, is going to be used as it is so regularly, that it needs to be challenged and politicized, that we can't just talk amorphously or abstractly about some sort of hip-hop nation and not look to see, well, what does it mean to be a nation, and what does it mean to be a nation, again, subsumed within a greater and broader colonial and international colonial apparatus. So if the hip-hop nation is a nation and people want to say that instead of talking about the Black nation, as was once more popular, then that too needs to be put in the context of this sort of, again, global imperial colonizing experience, and the relationship that nations have to one another needs to be seriously investigated. So there are a lot of versions of what it means to be a part of this hip-hop nation, and some take very what I would consider to be very conservative forms, and that's why some of my colleagues, Rosa Clemente among them, have tried to reclaim this phrase hip-hop radical, that if we're going to all be lumped in this hip-hop generation and hip-hop activists and all these kinds of phrases that I'm not really comfortable with, but popular nonetheless, then I think that we need to more clearly clarify and draw some of the, as you have said in your work, bright lines that we will use as standards for determining what is our nation and what is the direction of our nation. So as I'm arguing, it is a colonized, oppressed nation within a nation. It needs to see itself as such and adopt all the theoretical and practical tools that have historically been applied to colonized populations to get free.
There is still abroad in the land a kind of blind faith that new technology will somehow circumvent the corporate consolidation of media as we now know it.
Yeah, and this is one of the reasons why I wanted to revive or help or be part of a group who are helping to revive what some call this dead theoretical approach of internal colonialism, because all of the conditions that were used to measure the colonized status of people around the world, and including Black, Latin, and indigenous populations here, still exist. And some of those conditions are, in fact, much worse than they have been in the recent past or at any time in this country's history. Number one among them, of course, is mass incarceration and political imprisonment. So that is to say that because these old social relationships and relationships of power still exist, why would we think that so-called new technology or advanced technology would change those relationships when there is no history of that occurring in this country or anywhere around the world? So as many others have pointed out in many different times and many different contexts, I'm trying to do now to say that new technology doesn't improve social relationships and, in fact, intensifies, worsens, and deepens them. And in the case that I think now that we have with the Internet and new technology, media technology today, make those conditions less observable or less easy to isolate and identify and make known, even for those who are suffering them. To me, it's very simple. I mean, we do point to some more researched evidence in the book, but it, in many ways it's very simple. Over the last 30 or 40 years of the rise of this thing called the Internet, the gaps between Black and white and rich and poor have gotten wider. More people have gone to prison. We haven't released or made free any political prisoners. We haven't ended poverty or even advanced anywhere towards that. We haven't stopped wars. We haven't done so many of the things that most people want to have happen. So the idea that the Internet and Facebook are going to allow that to occur is in many ways just simply ridiculous. Now, there is much more, as I said, studied evidence that we point to in the book that people can look at and judge for themselves to make that point more clear. But that is just basically the point. So if these antagonisms still exist and these relationships still exist, why not go back to and reappreciate some of the traditions, in this case within hip-hop, and I would argue within the tradition of all oppressed communities struggling to develop a media and a journalism that represents their issues and their struggles and their desires for freedom. Why not apply that to the mixtape, and why not get back into it even in 2011, again, considering that so little of what we would want to have end in terms of these, you know, antagonistic relationships of power has actually ended.
To check out Dr. Jared Ball's book, go to the Internet and type in imixwhatilike.com.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my colleague Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Caitlin Fitzgerald.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.